So we're still discussing now eating mitzvahs of kosher food. And this week I wanted to discuss the different kosher species out there. One of the major laws in kosher is different species of animals that are kosher and non-kosher. So what I'll do is go through just the basics of what are the signs of a kosher animal, and we'll try to discuss the symbolism. Now keep in mind that these laws certainly are in the realm of a chok, which means that it's not really understandable to the human mind exactly why this is. The fact that these signs indicate it's kosher, and not these signs make it non-kosher, so it's very hard to find a rationale to that. But we'll try to give some symbolism.
That's what a chok is?
That's a chok, yeah.
Do it because
that's it, because God said so. Typically a chok, we say there's no rationale. Logic, the human mind doesn't really fathom why or why not, but we do it because that's what God said to do. So the fact that certain animals are kosher and certain aren't kosher, so we definitely call that a chok. Especially that these signs make it kosher, these signs make it not kosher, that's very hard to understand. But yeah, there is some symbolism given, there is meaning to it, so we can definitely try to grapple with the meaning and symbolism, but overall we definitely call this one a chok, and it's hard to know why these things make it better than other animals. So just to go through the basics, so when it comes to animals, meaning land animals, not birds, not fish, land animals, so the famous two signs of a kosher has to have split hooves and chew its cud. So probably people have seen split hooves, you know, in a cow or a goat, the hooves actually in the middle, they're divided. And chewing its cud, just the science of it is that a kosher animal has four different stomachs. It takes in its food. I forgot the names of the stomachs. It goes into one stomach, it gets partially digested there, it shoots it back up to the mouth, it chews it up again, and it goes back down to the other stomach. And that's chewing its cud. So it goes around these different stomachs in between, it goes back up to the mouth to be chewed up once again. That's chewing its cud. I think it goes back up twice, I think. Not all four times, twice. I think it goes back up twice.
And a goat does that too?
Yeah. I mean, you can see, if you ever go to see a farm or something, they sit there, well, that's the chewing its cud. You can watch them do it.
So, I've seen it, but I didn't realize they swallow it and it comes back up again.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's efficient. Yeah.
It took them a long time.
It doesn't sound very pleasant, that's for sure, but it's part of the digestive process for them. So that's chewing its cud. So those are the signs of a kosher animal. When it comes to fish, it has to have fins and scales. Those are the signs of a kosher fish. The rabbis tell us, though, if it has scales, we know it has fins. There's no fish out there that has scales without fins. So if you see a fin, you can't assume there's a scale. If you see scales, you could assume fins. So that's the sign of a kosher fish. But we shouldn't be misled, because sometimes things appear as a scale, but halachically don't qualify as a scale. So a halachic scale means you can actually scrape it off easily with your finger. There are certain fish that have what looks like scales, but scrape it off with your fingernail very easily. It's a halachic scale. Some fish might have on it what looks like scales, but they're very hard to remove. Those don't qualify in terms of halacha. So where I've seen it is if you ever see a trigger fish. I once was fishing and I caught a trigger fish. And I said, oh, there's scales on it. But then I went back and I looked at a list of kosher fish and it wasn't there. So I went to figure out why. Because on a trigger fish, the scales don't scrape off easily. That's not called a scale. Scale is something which is, halachically, a scale is something that scrapes off easily. So that is fins and scales. When it comes to birds, poultry, fowl, so the Torah gives us a list of non-kosher birds. It says these are the birds that are not kosher, and it gives you a list of about 15 birds or so.
They're
not kosher. Everything else is kosher when it comes to birds. The Torah does not define what a sign is of a kosher bird versus a not kosher bird. That's nowhere written in the Torah, but it lists all the non-kosher birds. So seemingly it's very easy. I'll look at the list and I'll figure out which ones are kosher. Everything else. What's tricky, though, is that you lose a lot in translation. I mean, the words used to define these species of birds were used in the Torah, say, 3,500 years ago, in ancient Hebrew. To understand what that word means in modern species is not so easy to know. So just because the Torah says ha-nates or ha-tinshames, lots of words used there, yanshuf, these are different types of birds mentioned. So how do we know how to translate it into modern terms that we know? And the fact that the modern Hebrew dictionary says that one is an owl, or is an eagle, or is a falcon, doesn't mean anything in terms of Torah usage. So that's where it gets a little bit tricky. So there is our custom is that we only eat birds that we have a tradition or kosher, since we don't know exactly how to define all the words of the Torah. So certainly the Ashkenazi custom, and I believe it's a Sephardic custom too, that only birds that there is a tradition passed down for generations, that these are the kosher species we eat, But there's no tradition about a bird, even though it seems to fit the description in the Torah. We don't, or doesn't, it doesn't fit the description of any non-kosher bird. We don't eat it. Only if we have a Masorah tradition do we eat it. Yes. It's true, but to a different extent, because animals, the Torah at least gives us the signs. But
yeah, it gives us the signs, but you're not going
to
eat it.
Correctly. Either way, right? Yeah, you're right. That's true. Either way, we also don't eat animals. We don't have a Masorah to eat as well. That's true. But it's just that when it comes to birds, it's much more difficult. It's much more likely to think that everything's okay because it's not one of the ones listed here. So that's the halacha of birds. Actually, there was a controversy with turkey a few centuries back because there was not a tradition amongst the Jewish people to eat turkey for many, many centuries. And if I remember correctly, they found, I think, one group of Jews, I forgot where, in one country, one community that ate turkey. So they had a tradition that turkey is okay. The rest of the Jewish people did not have that tradition. So for those of us, most Jews do eat turkey nowadays, we assume it's a kosher bird, but we're relying upon the tradition of that one sect of Jews who are eating turkey all the generations. But there are some controversies, everybody allowed to rely upon that. And I've met people who don't eat turkey because they don't have a tradition to eat turkey.
We have a friend whose son-in-law is from South Africa.
He won't eat turkey. Yeah, right. So they say, we don't have a tradition, it's a kosher bird, I can't eat it. Yeah. Right.
I find it unusual that they, in the Torah says, these birds are not kosher. Why does it list the ones that are not kosher instead of the ones that are?
Probably it lists the least amount would be listed, logically. So probably there's more kosher birds, technically, than unkosher birds. Since we don't know the definitions, we don't need as many birds. But I assume that the list of kosher, non-kosher birds is a smaller list than the list of kosher birds. So I would assume. The rabbis do tell us, though, even though the Torah doesn't give us any indicating signs for kosher birds, the rabbis say there are indicating factors. What the rabbis say is that these birds do not, they're not predators, they don't kill other animals. So any bird which is a predator is not kosher, that's for sure. Also, it says that they have an extra finger, which if you look at the, I don't know how to describe it, you look at the feet of like a chicken, there's another little like finger or claw a little bit further up, talon. So it's called a talon?
Yeah.
Right, so the kosher birds will have a talon. And they also have what's called a zephek in Hebrew and a korkovin. A zephek is an extra stomach, which I think the English is called a crop. And the korkovin, we call it the gizzard. And what's special about the korkovin, the gizzard of a kosher bird, is that there's a membrane that peels off very easily. So for those who are familiar with animal anatomy, but on a non-kosher bird, you don't have this membrane peeling off easily from the gizzard, which is another stomach of the bird. In a kosher bird, the membrane peels off very easily. So if you're ever checking out a bird, you can check out the membranes on the gizzard. Yeah.
I've always had a problem in my own mind with birds of prey.
Yeah.
Because you see little teeny birds, they're pulling up worms, they're eating other life forms.
Right. Well, I mean, the term used in the Mishnah is dores. Dores doesn't mean it just eats other animals. It means that it attacks. That it, you know, dores is an idea of like scraping or attacking with its claws. That's dores. So, I mean, the fact, I think, you know, chickens eat worms, and, you know, birds, they certainly, are kosher, do eat other animals. It's not that it eats other animals, but the fact that it's a attacking bird, the fact that it's, I guess, proactive in attacking other animals would be the point.
Okay.
So if you ever see, like, you know, an owl, or, like, the way an owl attacks, an owl goes down and swoops down and grabs at it, and it doesn't, you know, that's that type of thing. And the Mishnah also says that any bird, if you put it on, like, on a wire, and it wraps two fingers around one side of the wire, and two fingers around the other side of the wire, is there sure a non-kosher bird? So if you picture that, it goes, you know, it grabs on the wire like that. If the bird grabs onto the wire, two fingers in front, two fingers in back, that's for sure a non-kosher bird.
Okay, how many times are you going to see that? The bird's going to sit on a wire.
We probably won't.
Now we have to go look.
Right. That's true, but now you can watch. You know, sometimes you can be off, like, you know, at a park or something and see birds coming down. I don't know. But that's definitely a sign it's a non-kosher bird. Yeah, bird watchers definitely see these things. So that's the basic rules of kosher birds.
So the main things like chickens and turkeys and
duck.
But not these birds that you see flying around.
Yeah,
I mean, so you don't see the chickens and ducks,
not a parrot.
Right. So the main thing is.
Right. So even though technically it could be that a parrot. I don't think parrots are birds of prey. I don't know if they eat parrots, but I don't think birds of prey. But we have the tradition to eat parrots, so we won't eat them. Right. Okay. Yeah. We have the tradition to eat parrots, but technically it could be their kosher. You know. A lot of these different birds, a pigeon, like.
Well, a parrot go like that with your fingers.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So that's not. It does that. It's not kosher. So that, yeah, but we only eat the birds we have tradition for, which, I mean, in the world. I mean, there are very few birds that are common, as far as I know, besides chickens, turkeys, quail, ducks. And I don't know what else is even out there.
Is quail kosher?
Quail's kosher. I think so. I think quail's kosher. I don't know if you find it too often in kosher stores. I think it's kosher.
Doves.
People eat dove?
Doves? Doves kosher?
Well, the doves are brought as a sacrifice, so those are certainly kosher. Yeah.
Oh.
I'm saying that the two types of birds that are brought as sacrifices is called a yonah and a tor, I think, in Hebrew. I think we say it's a turtle dove and a dove. I don't know the difference between the two. But I think the translations given are turtle dove and dove. So those two birds are kosher. A tor or b'nei yonah, the two different birds listed as sacrifices. So those would be kosher for sure, whatever the translation of those are. But again, if we don't have a tradition that this bird is that one listed in the Torah.
Are they only sacrifice kosher animals?
Yes. Yeah. There was actually one terrible incident towards the end of the Second Temple where the city was under siege. But still, they were allowing in the daily sacrifice. They're allowing them to bring in the goats for the daily sacrifice. And then one day they wouldn't allow the animal in, and they sent in a pig. And that caused a tremendous uproar. They sent a pig into the temple, and that was one of the down points of the entire period of the Second Temple. Was that point? You know, they would never sacrifice an unkosher animal. So that's the idea of kosher birds. Now the fourth category, which we don't really eat, is there's some kosher locusts. The Torah lists.
Kosher what?
Locusts. Locusts.
What's that? Bugs?
Yeah. What type of bugs? The locusts come and they attack the crops.
Why? We have the locusts that leave the shell behind every 7 years. Well, they're every year now. They used to be 17-year locusts. Now they're every year.
Don't you think there's enough food in this world that we don't have to eat bugs?
Locusts.
Yeah. I think you're a common. I know we don't eat bugs.
Yeah.
But somebody said if it actually got chopped up into something, you don't have to throw away the whole thing.
But if there's 60 times the volume of that bug, if 60 times the volume of that bug, you end up to throw it all away.
Right.
But that's not those bugs aren't kosher. It's
no,
just
that
they just become nullified in the mixture. Okay. So the idea is just to give the basics. The kosher locusts, the Torah lists, I think, four or five different species of locusts that are kosher. It lists the kosher ones. The signs given are that they have four large wings that cover most of the body of the locust. They have four legs, and they have two additional long legs they hop on. That's what the Torah says. So those are the kosher locusts. And some say it actually has to have the... people have to refer to it as the word chagav, is the word used. So it has to be referred to as a chagav. The truth is, I mean, people do eat locusts even nowadays. I read an account, I mean, in places, I guess, where they don't have much food. But in Africa, I read an account that there was a locust... there was a swarm of locusts that came through, and people were very excited because they grab them out of the air and they store them up and they pickle them and they eat them all year long, these locusts. They're very large bugs, so I guess there's a lot of meat. I don't know. But those are the species of locusts. I think that some Sephardim still have a tradition to which are the kosher locusts. Ashkenazi Jews don't eat locusts, to my knowledge. I think there are some Sephardic Jews who have a tradition.
They list the ones that are kosher.
Are listed,
whereas
yeah.
the other one, they list the
ones that are not but birds. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I assume they always list the smallest list. So there's more species of locusts that are non-kosher, so list the kosher species. There's more species of birds that are kosher, so list the non-kosher species. That's my assumption. So those are the basic rules of kosher animals. You have different rules for animals, for fish, for birds, and for locusts. Besides that, no other animals are kosher to eat. And when we talk about kosher animals, it also includes the milk. A non-kosher animal's milk is not kosher. The kosher animal's milk is kosher. That's another important rule to know. So if they do have places where they might use camel milk or pig milk or something along those lines, that is not kosher as well, because the milk has the same status as the animal itself. Which is why the rabbis instituted the custom of Chol Yisrael. Chol Yisrael means that a Jew has watched the milking of the animal and is 100% sure that this is certainly kosher milk and not non-kosher milk. So that's the cousin of Chol Yisrael. Until recent times, Chol Yisrael was 100% a requirement because we could not trust that the bottle of milk labeled cow's milk was actually cow's milk. Maybe it was pig milk or camel's milk or something else. Rav Moshe Feinstein said that in modern-day America, one can be lenient with that because since the government has such strict standards, we can rely upon the government that the milk labeled cow's milk is certainly cow's milk.
Is that only the United States?
Yes, the only United States. Other countries, you don't have such government standards. Each country has to be looked at individually. So it could be there are other, you know, if you go to to other countries in Europe that might have some strict government standards as well, you can rely upon that. But if you go to Africa or South America, where the government may not be as involved in the food process, so then you can't rely upon that. For sure not. But Rav Moshe Feinstein was only the one he was paskening for that. Yes?
What about Israel? Is milk, they're all kosher, but they have to be called kosher.
I think it all is called kosher. I mean, I don't think... Oh. I don't know if they even produce milk that you'll find in a kosher store, which is not called Israel there. I mean, I assume they don't rely upon Rav Moshe's heter, because, I mean, I don't know if the standard is the same as Israel either. Because government inspections there are not quite the same as in America,
but
my knowledge.
The milk, even the regular milk, quite often has an OU on it.
Yeah, but the OU does not mean it's called Israel.
No, I know that.
Yeah.
But you know it's from a kosher animal, as you were saying.
Right, but the OU did not watch, they didn't watch the milking process.
So oh, okay.
They're telling you, based on... circumstantial evidence, basically. They didn't actually see it themselves. Okay. That OU and the milk is.
So what's the point of any extra?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Sales. Profits. I don't know.
Oh.
The star K is always called Yisrael. If you see a star K on milk, that means it's called Yisrael for sure.
Really?
Yeah, star K is always called Yisrael. The star K has a separate symbol, the star D.
Yeah.
That's not called Yisrael. But it's the same, it's under the star K, but it's not Chol Yisrael. But a star K always means Chol Yisrael. So it's something good to know.
It doesn't have the D on it.
No, even with the D. I mean, a star K D is always Chol Yisrael, but they also have a star D.
Oh, gotcha.
The star D is not Chol Yisrael, but it's still under the star K's supervision.
Is the D
Yeah. But they don't put the star K there. They put the star D there.
The star K
so that's why they started the star
it's,
D.
The star K, it's... I think it's a, as I mean, a five-pointed star with a D in the middle.
D
yeah, I think a five-pointed star with a D in the middle. With a K in the middle, excuse me.
I think they say it all awesome.
That's the Baltimore's kind of contrast.
But I never thought to look and see.
You know, I don't know if you find the what do you call it, Chol Yisrael cheese, it's like, I think it's halam, it's much more expensive than the regular, let's say, Miller's. Do you know
right.
The reason for that?
Probably because they have to pay for stricter hashgacha, that's what it is. But that is true, though. I mean, the Costco kosher cheese is called Yisrael. The brand they sell at Costco is called Yisrael, and it's cheaper than buying Miller's cheese. So it's better you buy it. But anyway, Chol Yisrael, they're paying for the mashgiach to spend extra time and effort in watching over the milk. I actually went in the summer. I took my family, went down to Lancaster, the Amish country, and we went to the farm that produces the local Chol Yisrael milk. It's called Kreider Farms. It's a very large dairy farm. But the pride of the farm is the brand you find around here. And they produce their milk at that farm. So we actually took a tour, and they gave us a Chol Yisrael chocolate milk at the end. It was very interesting. They showed us the Mashkiach trailer. There's a trailer there where he lives when he's there, I guess, the Mashkiach. They don't run, it's not always Chol Yisrael, but they run a Chol Yisrael run once every week, once every few weeks, whatever it is. So that's down in Lancaster, at least for the local Chol Yisrael.
Interesting.
So, if, say a farm only had cows on it, you'd still have to have the mashgiach there all the time to watch the cows being milked.
To watch the milking. I mean, if the farm had no, there's a discussion, if the farm has no way to bring in other animals, then you know it's a cow. But if not for that, to make it Chol Yisrael, you have to have somebody actually watching the milking itself. That's a Chol Yisrael. So, I mean, Chol Yisrael, it's, in America, especially outside New York, it's not that easy to find. I mean, a lot of kosher cheeses are Chol Yisrael, some are, some aren't. But overall, Rav Moshe Feinstein is lenient with it in America overall because of the government standards. But his opinion is disputed, and that's why many people, even in America, only drink Chol Yisrael milk. Because Rav Moshe Feinstein, it's a big leniency if you look through all the sources in Halacha.
When did he make that?
I assume it was in the, maybe the 60s or so, 50s or 70s. I don't know the exact date on it. But it only applies in America. Every country has to be looked at its own right. So you have strict are the government standards. Can we rely upon this or not? That's the history of
how does one do that? If one goes to a foreign country, how does one
I guess
do that?
Speak
does
to the local drink? Rabbis to see if they have any opinion on the matter. I don't know. Yeah.
Could you tell with
DNA now? I assume you could. I assume you could, but you're not going to start DNA testing every single bottle of milk you buy either. I assume that DNA could be able to tell which animal it came from. I'm not sure if that would satisfy the halacha requirement, because the halacha gives you very specific guidelines on how to do it, and also it's not practical. But I assume it is something which is ascertainable through scientific examination, and we know what the milk is. That's how the government would inspect. They're going to take samples and test it and see what it is. So I assume that would... that would definitely determine what the milk is. If that would satisfy the halachic requirement, that would be a different question. Right, so those are the basics of kosher animals. Now I want to try to get into a little bit of the symbolism. Remember that these, we call it chukim, these are laws which don't really have a logical explanation. There's not really a rationale to it. It's something which is beyond the human mind to fully understand. We already discussed in general a few weeks ago that kosher food overall has three, you know, general meanings, which we said some authorities discuss as physically healthy, emotionally healthy, and spiritually healthy. We discussed that. So that certainly applies to these species as well. How it is that the split hoof and chewing of the cud makes it healthier to the spirit or to the emotions or to the body, that's harder to understand. That's for sure. But these are chukim, so any reason we give for it, any symbolism we give, is only going to kind of touch the surface of it, but it's very hard to really know what the depth of it is. So let's just start with a few sources describing the symbolism of why an animal that's kosher needs to have split hooves and chew its cud. That's one of the most famous signs out there, split hooves and chew its cud. Let's understand what could be the symbolism of that. So one commentary, which is the Abarbanel, he gives a very practical need for this requirement. He says that animals which have split hooves and chew their cud. So that means these animals, they are grass eaters. They don't eat meat, they don't eat bones, they just eat grass. That's why their system works in the way it does, because the grass goes down, it kind of stores it away a little bit, it moves it to the next stomach, it shoots it back up again. But physically, these are all grass eaters. Grass is an abundant food, and grass is a nutritious food. So he says that this means these animals overall are going to be healthier animals because they have an abundance of grass to eat, and the grass is a nutritious food for them to eat. That's the Abarbanel's explanation. So Malagira, the fact that they chew their cud.
I'm sorry, that there's an abundance of grass, and the grass is what else?
Is a nutritious, food for the animal. So these animals will tend to be healthier, healthier animals, stronger animals. Additionally, he said that, we always say we are what we eat. And what you eat, certainly for a human, determines a lot about you on many levels, physically, emotionally, and spiritually, as we've discussed. So too, an animal which eats grass, we assume, is a more even-keeled, animal. An animal which preys on other animals or eats meat, we look at it as more of a cruel and, vicious or violent animal. So it's typically, in general, the sign of chewing cud is a sign which shows the animal is a grass eater, which means that it's going to be a calm and relaxed and animal which itself has good, so-called character. So it will give to us good character as well. And the truth is, cows kind of sit there and mind their own business. Goats, I guess a deer is a kosher animal. Deers are a little more active than cows and goats, but also they're not known to be predators. They're not known to be dangerous. We have plenty of deer around here, and besides eating your garden, they don't do much else. So and that's what the Abarbanel says. In terms of Mafras Parsa, that it has split hooves. So he explains that this is as opposed to having claws. Because split hooves cannot be used to attack. One hoof, or I guess a claw or any other type of nail they can use to attack, that would show that it's not a peaceful animal. It's a violent or vicious animal. Split hooves typically indicate that the animal is going to be a very pleasant and peaceful animal. That's the Abarbanel explains. Again, it's not 100% accurate, because I'm sure there are some animals that have one hoof, not split hooves, that are also peaceful animals. But overall, these are indicating factors the animal is going to be a peaceful, even-keeled, healthy, grass-eating animal. That's what these signs both represent. Similarly, there's another commentary called the Eitz Chaim. He says it shows the animals are not aggressive animals. They're more passive animals. And we have a concept overall of it, that God loves those who are passive, not aggressive. God takes care of those who are underdogs, those who are pursued. God looks at those who are lowly and humble and helps them out and takes care of them. So animals which are more calm, are not aggressive, those are the ones that God favors. It's a sign the animal is a peaceful animal. Therefore, it's appropriate to ingest this animal and make it part of yourself, because this animal stands for peace and passivity rather than for fighting and violence. So that's another similar explanation. There's another, let's call it a deeper, more Kabbalistic explanation. This is said by the Sefer, it's called Nachal Kidumim, is the author of this work. And he says that split hooves represent the two worlds. We have this world, Olam Hazeh, and we have the world to come, Olam Haba. And he doesn't mention this, but I would say the symbolism would be that, we plant ourselves down in the world we live in. And a Jew has to always live in two worlds. We have to be firmly planted in this world, but also understand that we have to be firmly planted in the next world. And we have to live our life with the next world in mind, even though we're living in this physical world right now. We have to live life always with the goal to be firmly planted in another world as well. So having split hooves shows that my hooves are planted in two different spots. I put myself down in this world, and I put myself down in the next world. That's the symbolism of split hooves. One hoof means that I'm here in one spot. I'm in one spot. I don't have another world on my mind. I'm here in one spot. So he says that chewing the cud is a very similar symbolism. Because chewing cud means that we eat two ways. We eat in this world and eat in another world. Let me just expand on that for a second. The chewing cud physically, it takes in its food. We said it goes down to the stomach. It gets digested partially. And it shoots it back up to the mouth. It chews it up again and then goes back down to the stomach again. So it's an eating process which happens more than once. It eats once in one way, it eats a second time in a different way. So performing mitzvahs in this world does the same thing for us. If you perform a mitzvah, you get reward in this world, but that reward also will remain for the next world too. So I will be able to experience spiritual rewards in the world I'm in right now, but also I'll experience spiritual rewards in a different way in the next world. So chewing cud is symbolic of the fact that you eat once and you eat again. I enjoy in this world and I enjoy in the next world. So he's saying that the kosher species is representative of a Jew living in two worlds, that we have to live our lives firmly planted in this world, functioning and accomplishing in this world, but also understanding that we have to be constantly trying to achieve a greater spot in the world to come. And we'll get reward in the world to come as well, in addition to the reward the reward we have within this world. That's his point. So that's, I guess, a little deeper, more Kabbalistic explanation, but also very fascinating. So that would tell us that kosher animal represents a Jew, to be firmly planted in two different worlds. Yeah.
I got him closer to earning your bread.
Earning your bread.
Bread.
Earning your bread.
So you do a mitzvah.
Good. So that's the split hooves. I'm in two different worlds. I keep my feet in two places at once. Another interesting point, and this is a little more general, more generic, I guess, but the two signs of a kosher animal, there's one internal sign and one external sign. Chewing cud is a very internal process. It has to do with digestion, the stomach. You don't see the cud, just, you know, goes in and out. You don't actually see the animal's cud. The hooves are external. So hooves are, the animal can show you, here are my hooves. You can go to the zoo and look at the hooves and you can see if the hooves split or not. So symbolically that means that to be kosher, you need to have two parts of yourself. You have to have internal kashrus and external kashrus, meaning I have to have internal feelings. My heart has to be sincere and in line with God's will, and my actions have to match with that as well. Somebody with neither of those, if neither your actions nor your heart are in line with God, that's certainly somebody who's not doing God's will. That's somebody who we call, you know, a Russia, or somebody who's not going the right path in life. But having one sign also is sufficient. The Torah lists four different animals that only have one sign. The Torah says a pig has split hooves, doesn't chew its cud. And it lists three other animals. And again, translations are not 100% accurate. But typically, the animals listed, Gomal is a camel, that's clear. A camel chews its cud, doesn't have split hooves. The other two words used in the Torah are Shafan and Arnevis. So Shafan, one translation given is a hyrax, which is, I believe, some sort of like a beaver-type animal that you find in the mountains. And then a hare is the Arnevis, is translated as a hare. So again, translations, you never know if they're 100% accurate. The translations I'm using I got from a book called The Living Torah by Rabbi Arya Kaplan. Rabbi Kaplan was known to be, he died very young. He wrote a tremendous amount of works. He's a very intelligent, encyclopedic person. And his translations are viewed to be, you know, very accurate translations. So I used his book to get translations for these animals. But again, nothing is definite. But the example is given in the Torah of having only one sign, or the pig has split hooves, doesn't chew its cud. The camel chews its cud. The hare and the hyrax all chew their cud, but don't split hooves. So those animals have only one sign. So the pig, for instance, externally looks kosher. Look at me, my hooves are kosher, but its inside is not kosher. It represents a person who externally might perform God's mitzvahs and externally looks religious, but internally does not have the feelings. So that's also a trait. And the other type of person is somebody who internally has feelings, but doesn't act on them. So the camel, the shafan, and the arnevis, which we're calling the hyrax and the hare, those animals, internally, they chew their cud. So internally, they're kosher. You know, their hearts with God. Their feelings are in line with God's will. But externally, you don't see them performing based on their emotions and their heart. That's also treif. To be kosher, you need to have both your heart and your actions in line with one another. That creates a kosher animal. So why these two are the actual signs, I'm not explaining. But the fact there's an internal sign and an external sign is a very powerful lesson. That the goal of a Jew is to have both his or her heart and his or her actions in line with one another, performing God's will. So that's the kosher animal. So that's some meaning and symbolism behind kosher animals. Then there's fish. So kosher fish, the signs are the scales and fins. So there's some more practical explanations and some deeper explanations to this as well. So one practical explanation I saw given was that in general, fish that have scales and fins are they live near clean water, and they're top dwellers. The animals don't have these signs, typically are living in dirtier water or towards the bottom of the ocean where it's not as healthy. So we have to do a scientific analysis of all the different kosher fish to see where they live. But certainly, you know, crabs and lobsters and shellfish typically are near the bottom, to my knowledge. And most of the fish we eat do swim somewhat near the top of the water, closer to the sunlight in the cleaner area. I'm sure there's some exceptions both ways, but that's one explanation given. Yeah.
Okay, there's two different animals that make the techeles, the blue color.
Yeah.
There's a snail and there's some kind of a fish, I forget the name of the fish. Are those kosher animals or is only the techeles?
I don't think so. I think it's just the techeles we use, but I don't think it's a kosher animal to eat. I don't think so. I could be wrong, but I don't
think
so.
The cuttlefish, that's what it is, yeah. Cuttlefish makes the
tachilas. Oh, yeah? Usually the Gemara refers to the chila zone, which we translate as some form of a snail, typically. But, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just
playing
tonight.
Okay. Yeah. That's for sure. We're just trying to figure out what makes the spirits of these animals worse than the spirit of the kosher animals. What kind of grasp can we have intellectually on such a thing? So ultimately it's a chok, and the reason that a lobster's spirit is bad to ingest is a chok. We don't fully understand why. But we do, again, we're giving some form of explanation as to what some symbolism may be behind these rules. Now there is one explanation which we'll close up with this. It'll take us a little bit of time. It's a very deep Kabbalistic explanation of it, but I found it to be very fascinating. This explains both the signs for the kosher locusts and the kosher fish. It's from a book, it's called Oros HaMitzvah, which is a Kabbalistic work which explains the depth behind certain mitzvahs. And he explains a very interesting concept. What he says is that fish having scales can be viewed as a form of clothing on the fish. A fish that has scales, it's just naked skin. And scales are another layer put onto the skin that we would use as some sort of clothing on the skin. Which actually fits in with the halacha that a scale has to peel off easily. If it's part of the skin, doesn't peel off easily, it's not called a scale halachically. It has to peel off easily to be a halachic scale. That's as a form of clothing. He says also, the sign of a kosher locust we describe is that it has four large wings covering its entire body. It also is a form of being clothed. The body, you don't see the naked body, you see a clothed locust. Now, it sounds very strange to us what that means. So he says, in short, that it's a lesson to us that we shouldn't be unclothed from mitzvahs. And mitzvahs protect us, just like clothes protect us. That would be one basic understanding of it. But it goes a lot deeper as well. We'll explain, well, just give me a minute, we'll try to explain the depth of it. But he says that's with clothing. It's on the fish and on the grasshopper, there's clothing. He also describes that fins are, they help the fish float to the top of the surface. You know, the fish is able to swim with its fins and stay near the top. The Torah is compared to water. Torah, just like water, is life. Torah provides life to us, spiritual life. There's the humility involved in studying Torah, and water always goes to the lowest point, just like Torah symbolizes humility. So our fins that keep us afloat, he says, we also have fins, which are our human minds. They keep us afloat. The human mind helps us, you know, get through these waters and stay on the top. And therefore, our minds should be used to keep us afloat and navigate the Torah. That's in short how he explains it. So the fins kind of keep the fish afloat, the water represents the Torah, and our minds are our fins to keep us afloat in the waters of Torah. So, yeah?
Are the fins hollow?
Are the fins hollow? I'm not sure.
I'm just thinking, could it have a more things.
Right, that could be. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. That's interesting. The so let's understand this for a second. What would be the depth of this? And it's also there's a discussion quoted in other books as well. There's a book called Eitz Chaim, the Kabbalistic Work, and he says that he tries to describe how come clothing is considered positive and the non-clothed animal is considered a negative thing. And it really dates itself back to the very beginning of the Torah, because the Torah describes the snake in the Garden of Eden, and it says the Nachash Haya Arum. He was Arum Mikol Behem of all the animals. The word Arum in Hebrew has two translations. It might mean clever, but it might mean naked. It says that Adam and Eve were Arumim. They were naked because they weren't wearing any clothing. Same term used to describe the snake. So you pick up your English translation of the Torah, it'll translate it there as the snake was clever. That's how it translated it as. But the word also has double meaning. The snake was naked is the other meaning of it. The snake was Arum, it was naked. So the Kabbalistically, something which is evil or which is false is described as it's naked. And something that belongs in the world of goodness, in the world of holiness, is clothed. So, in addition, the grasshopper is kosher, has these long legs to jump on, and that helps to keep it afloat. It's like the fish has the fins to keep it afloat. So there's a concept that anything which is false, the rabbis tell us, has no legs, is the term used. And there's a simple and there's a deeper explanation to it. But the Hebrew word for something false is the word sheker, shin, kuf, and resh. The form of each of those letters only has 1 foot to stand on. The shin comes down on the bottom to 1 foot. The kuf has that 1 point going down as 1 foot. And the resh comes down as 1 foot. The word in Hebrew for truth is emes. And each letter in emes has 2 feet. Aleph has 2 feet. A mem has 2 feet. And the tav has 2 feet. Because truth stands firm, and something which is false stands on one leg and falls over. It doesn't last. So the that's 1 point. So you see that in letters. And in reality, it's true. Anything which is real will last. Anything which is false eventually falls apart. We see that time and time again. People live a life of lies, so everything comes crumbling at a certain point. People live a life of sincerity, so things kind of maintain itself and remain solid. So the fish has its fins, which are equivalent to its legs, is what this book says. And the chagav, the locust, has its extra legs to stand on, which help it jump. And those are its legs, because they come from a world of truth, not a world of falsehoods. The idea of being clothed or naked is a very deep idea as well. The concept that evil is naked, you could understand the following way. And this is another, if you look through many deeper works of Torah, Kabbalistic works, Hasidic works, constantly we talk about clothing ourselves in mitzvahs, clothing ourselves in good traits. Because the idea of clothing is that I am who I am, but I want to express myself. Clothing allows me to express myself for beyond that which is just who I am. So a person, I mean, just on a very simple level, you express yourself through what you wear. You're going to a fancy party, you wear fancy clothing. It's cold out, you put on warmer clothing. If you're going to the beach, you put on different clothing. If you're going to mow your lawn, put on different clothing. Because clothing is an expression of who you are, which is why we like buying different types of clothing, and we like styles, and because we're trying to express ourselves through clothing. Without clothing, so just we are what we are, and there's no further expression. To the naked eye, there's no further expression beyond what the person is. Clothing helps us express ourselves. The idea of clothing also protects. It allows us to be warm. It allows us to be protected from the sunlight. Clothing protects us as well. So clothing is meant to express ourselves beyond the physical. It's meant to protect us. It's meant to maintain us. Which really leads into the different ideas of tznius and modesty in Judaism, is because we're trying to show not just the body, but I go far beyond my physical body. So my clothing covers my body, but expresses me as a different person. I'm not just a body. I'm much more than a body. I'm a soul. I'm a mind. I'm a human being. So the idea of covering ourselves and remaining modest is that idea that I'm not only a physical body, I'm much more than that. I express myself in a way far beyond my physical body. The concept you find in Hasidic works is that a person will clothe themselves in a good deed. Because what does that mean? Because when I'm about to do something good, I'm expressing, my self-expression is coming through that good deed. I'm going to do a chesed, help somebody else. That's my personal self-expression. I'm not only my physical body. I have an additional way to express myself through the deed that I'm actually performing. So we refer to that metaphorically as you've clothed yourself in that good deed. The role of evil in the world, evil says that there's no further expression of the human being. You're a physical body, you are what you are, there's nothing more that you can connect with, there's nothing deeper. So therefore, anything which is evil we look at as naked. The snake was naked. The physical world is all it's about. You know, forget what God told you. Just know that this is what it is. There's no deeper expression to who you are. And the world of goodness and sanctity says, no, there's a very deep expression to myself. I can express myself in a much deeper way. Don't look at the physical body. Look beyond that. That's the idea of being, metaphorically, it's the idea of being clothed. And on a deeper level, you know, the goodness of God is so far beyond us. It can't exist without being clothed in something we can relate to. The idea of a mitzvah is that God has some eternal spiritual idea which is so lofty and holy, it's way out of our world. And any mitzvah we do is trying to bring that lofty, spiritual, holy idea into our world. So that idea takes on, it's clothed in something physical. So there's some lofty, deep concept, let's say, in a piece of matzah. And when I eat it on Pesach, I'm now in a physical, it's clothing itself in the matzah, and I'm able to tap into this very, very deep spiritual concept through a very physical form, because it's kind of put on the matzah as its clothing, as the metaphor used. I guess a metaphor we could use would be like, say, computer software. You can have a computer program, but without the computer to put into, it's worthless. A computer software, without a computer, isn't going to help you, because you can't put it in, you can't actually use it, utilize it, without having the proper tool to utilize it with. So these lofty, spiritual, deep ideas, if they don't clothe themselves in a world, in a physical world in some way, you can't access them. We cannot access God, because God is so far out there without having God clothing these concepts in physical terms. Yeah. Yeah. So matzah is a clothing on a certain spiritual idea. Every mitzvah is clothing on an idea.
You mean matzah for Passover?
Matzah Passover. Matzah Passover would be the clothes put on by the spiritual idea, which allow us to access that idea. Without that, we couldn't access the idea. So overall, just I'll end with this, and we're going late. Overall, the concept. This is a very deep Kabbalistic concept, but the kosher fish has its clothing, the kosher locust has its clothing, because the world of goodness and sanctity always presents itself clothed. It has to, you can't access lofty ideas out of being enveloped in some physical form, and also clothing represents as something deeper expressing itself to the outside. Things which are evil or false, we refer to as naked, they're arum, like the snake in the Garden of Eden, because something which is very physical, you can grasp it as it doesn't need to clothe itself. It is what it is. It doesn't need to present itself in a deeper way. And it's also showing that I have nothing deeper to express to you. I am what I am. That's it. I'm just this physical thing in front of you. That's the world of evil. There's no clothing it's expressing itself through. So that's the idea of the clothes of the... That's the idea of the wings of the grasshopper and the idea of the scales and the fish. The fins and the... What? Or the locust. The idea of the locust. The wings of the locust. And the idea of the fins and the hopping legs of the locust are the idea that falsehood has no legs to it. Something which is false only has one leg and it falls over. Something which is true stands firm. Like the Hebrew words we said, MS and Sheker. Sheker only has one foot. MS, the letters have 2 feet on them. And in life we always find that things which are true and solid will remain and they hold firm. Things which are false and fantasy and lies will inevitably fall apart at some point. So that's why the kosher fish has its fins, which keep it up. The kosher locust has its extra legs to keep it hopping and keep it high in the air. And so too, things which are true have their legs to keep them firm, and things which are false fall over and eventually deteriorate. So we'll stop with that. So kosher fish and kosher locusts will be clothed and have firm legs. So that's the deeper concept behind those two species.